Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There was just all these other people there, hadn't got a clue who they were, but of course they were the oncology team. So basically just said, I'm really sorry, but Lynn has leukemia. I'll never forget it. I just looked at this picture and I remember Lynn just sat there and she sort of cried. And it was just terrific, you know.
Welcome to Grief Encounters with me, Sasha Hamrogue.
And I'm Venetia Quick. We're a weekly podcast that looks at an issue that affects us all and yet remains so difficult to talk about.
We'll be chatting to guests from all walks of life on the subject of death and all that comes with it.
Our main aim is to motivate, comfort, and create a modern space for people to share their own experiences.
Could you think of someone that could benefit in listening? Tell them about Grief Encounters, out every single Tuesday.
I think this week's episode is probably, for me, was the most difficult conversation I've probably ever had, I think, with someone. We spoke to Jane McKenna. She's the founder of the Laura Lynn Hospice. For people who don't know, Laura Lynn is the only children's hospice in Ireland. Mm. And it is named after her two daughters who both passed away.
Mm, and it's quite a... It's one of those stories that you actually make a film or a book. Mm. You can't sort of make it up. Yeah. And then when you hear it, you sort of go, how can that possibly happen to one person on the one day?
Yeah.
I agree. It sort of was one of the more difficult ones. I think the one or two we've done where we've talked about the passing of kids and kids dying, I find, and I know you do as a mum, that it's the more difficult ones because you can sort of find some sort of rationale when somebody's older to a certain extent, but when they're little...
No.
That's just really hard to do. And it was another one of those interviews that you sort of sitting there and when you finish, you realise you've got all the tears streaming down your face.
Oh, I know.
You know, without realising it during the actual chat.
And that can, I'm sure that must be hard for Jane because her story is so
traumatic.
Unimaginable and traumatic. And when people hear it, I think it's hard not for the emotion not to just sort of pour out. Obviously, like you'll probably hear, I'm... embarrassingly bawling through the whole thing, but I think that she tells the story from really in great detail to us, and it was really remarkable that she was willing to sit down and remember all of that with us
And share it. And I think anyone who doesn't know the story that will be quite taken aback. I think this is an episode that's going to sit with a lot of people for a long time.
Jane McKenna is the founder of Ireland's only children's hospice, the Laura Lynn Foundation, both named after her two children, Laura and Lynn. Sadly, her vision to create the National Children's Hospice was spawned from tragedy. Jane and her husband, Brendan, suffered an unthinkable loss in 1999 and 2001, as both Laura and Lynn passed away to different illnesses, age 4 and 15. Jane is here to speak about her family's story and what motivated her to give back in her grief. Can you tell us, just to start off, a little bit about your family's story?
Yeah, we were married 6 years before we had Lynn, and Lynn was born fine, perfectly healthy. I had a tough time. The birth was pretty kind of, I had a hemorrhage at the birth and I had a hemorrhage 2 weeks later. So it was kind of, it was pretty iffy, but she was fine anyway, which I suppose was the main thing. And I was fine in time, of course. And the little girl we waited for a while. and, you know, finally had. And Lynn, as I say, perfectly healthy. You know, she was an only child for nearly 9 years, but she was quite outgoing, and she went to a co-educational school, which was one of the first ones actually in Dublin. For an only child, she was quiet, and she was quiet in one way, but she wasn't in another way, you know. And then she went to a drama. I joined her in a drama as well when she was about, I think she was only four or something, and she absolutely loved that. She really loved it and kind of thrived from it, you know. I think that brought her out of herself a lot. So she always wanted this little sister. And she wasn't planned or not planned. And again, when we came to be pregnant with Laura, Lynn was nearly nine when she was born. Yeah. And I suppose I secretly, you know, people were saying to me, I think it's going to be a boy this time. And probably for Brendan, I was kind of thinking, yeah, well, that'd be nice. But in a secret way, I wanted the girl, and I knew Lynn wanted the sister. Yeah. So I suppose when I looked at it then afterwards, you know, I thought, well, whatever, if it was a boy or a girl, once they were fine. But unfortunately, when Laura was born, we kind of knew fairly straight away that there was a problem, and it was her heart. Well, they said it was a hole in the heart. It was something that was repairable, that she should come out the other end of. So that was all pretty positive, while it was a shock at the same time. Basically, a little bit of the joy was kind of gone, you know, because of the not knowing what was ahead, or, you know, the shock, I suppose, of having something wrong with your child. We kind of knew the day after she was born in the rotunda that there was a problem. She just wasn't feeding well. And they brought her over to Crumlin, and I was still in the rotunda, and I remember sitting there in the room, you know, and everybody else had their babies and she was gone. And of course, not knowing what it was, or, you know, all that sort of stuff as well. And then for Lynn too, you know, she'd come in to see her, and I don't know, I can't remember at what stage we told her, whether she knew at that stage, because she was only nine at that point. But anyway, I got out fairly quick. That the birth was a lot easier than Lynn's had been, and we went over to Crumlin, and I remember the consultant, Dr. Duff, he was a lovely man. He did say to us, you know, she wasn't on anything, she wasn't on oxygen or anything like that, so that was kind of positive as well. And he explained what it was and what would happen, and he just said, she'll probably never be a world class athlete, but she'll be fine. Okay. Well, as he thought, and we thought, that's fine, we don't want to do class athlete. Yeah, we'll take that. We're quite happy with that. Yeah. So that was the start of the journey, basically.
So after that, obviously Laura had some operations for the heart.
She had.
So every time she went into an operation, you know, that's a big worry for a parent, even when their child is going in for like a tonsillectomy or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
How was, obviously, for you and your family and for Lynn, what was that like every day when you watched her go through the doors?
It was pretty tough. She didn't actually go in until she was almost 7 months old. So we kind of had her at home for that stage.
Still tiny.
She was, still very tiny and still. And she was fairly good up to that. You know, she didn't have to be on anything particularly or that. I don't think she was even on medication. But they knew, like, they kind of said they'd leave it as long as they could so she wouldn't be too young. And then they put a shunt in the heart. So that was the start of it. So she went in, I think it was August that year as well, and had the shunt put in. And it seemed to have gone okay on the day we were there, but the following day the figures on the machines weren't looking good, and they didn't know what was wrong. And so he came back in, which was a Thursday, I remember, and he was probably after being operating in other places himself, I think. But anyway, he came in, he brought her down to theatre at 7 o'clock in the evening, and Lynn was staying with friends because, again, you were trying to work around her. Again, I don't know how much she kind of took in or how much she knew. She would have been 10 at this stage. But anyway, he took her down to theatre, and the consultant would come up and down every so often. And actually, at one point then they said, well, we think you should get Lynn in because we're not quite sure, things are not looking great. We did get Lynn in, and it really wasn't looking good from what we heard. But anyway, around 11 o'clock, I think it was, something like that, and he came up after finally bringing her around. A shunt had got, or a clot had gone through the shunt, and he had opened and closed her several times, and every time he closed her, the machines would drop again. I don't understand the full ins and outs of it, but that's how he explained it. And eventually he found the clot, luckily enough, and he kind of saved her life. He was actually tempted to do the full repair, but because she was so young, and she was on ventilation for quite a while, and she was literally in the hospital most of the time.
Probably set the seed, did it, that this mightn't go the way you were hoping it would go.
Yeah, I don't think it was ever going to be as clear as we thought initially. You know, for them, they ended up taking the top lobe of her right lung off just before that Christmas. Anytime she'd come out, she'd seem fine when you were going out at her at the door, and the next day she'd be back, the breathing and the whole thing. So they felt this was the answer. So that was literally just before that Christmas. And I really thought she had failed so much because she'd been through a lot and she wasn't as well. She wasn't eating. Obviously, she couldn't. And she had ate fairly well for a heart child, you know, to a degree. But I didn't think she'd come out of the theatre. I think it was November. It wasn't long before Christmas or early December. I can't remember exactly. But she did. She came through. And she spent her first Christmas and her first birthday then on the 20th of January in ICU, which was pretty horrific. She was still on ventilation and that. The ventilation she was going on, and the longer they're on ventilation, the harder it is to get them off and stuff like that. And then the feeding, of course, they're fed through the tube and they lose the touch for the mouth and all that. But anyway, she did come out shortly after her birthday. She came out and she did okay, like very weak and stuff. And I remember going home and I remember thinking, I can't press a button here anymore. You know, at least she can. Even though I was delighted to have her home in one way, but it was nerve-wracking. Yeah, she still had the feed tube
and sort
in
of
and all
encompassing in one way, considering you also had Lynn's needs as well.
I always feel equal. Yeah, they don't time. They really don't. That's what I always feel, because I look at, you know, Laura Lynn House now and you see the sick child takes priority naturally, and you know, the other siblings, you know, it is very hard for them as well, you know. It's, I think it's awful. But anyway, she did. And actually, before we left, a nurse, she was really great, this nurse, one, they were all great in their own way, but you know, there's always one or two that are really special. And she had insisted on trying to get her to eat again, because you see, they don't want to eat because they're getting so many things, the suctioning and all that. And she did start it. She got a big, huge, what do you call them? That you put a needle in. Oh my God, I can't think of
syringe.
Syringe. And she put the thing in that, got it sort of mashed up and started to get it in. So by the time we got her home, she was beginning to eat, because her children are not great eaters anyway, at the best of times. So she did. She came around. We went back in March then for a visit, you know, to check her and that. And obviously she was going to be back and forward a lot, and she was on various medications and that. She came out after that then, and she never looked back, even, you know, she really, until, you know, it came to the time for the final. And again, of course, anyone who's been to Crumlin or knows Crumlin, you know, the cancellations, I don't know, many times they were cancelled. And now it kind of went on. They were going to wait till she was a little bit older. And obviously, and she did. She, you know, we always say she was a little Shirley Temple. She really was. She had beautiful curls. And Lynn had the straight hair like mine. She had the curly hair like Brendan's, probably, because he had that. And she just was. And she, I don't know, you know, I often say, did she kind of nearly know? Now, of course she didn't. But and I don't know what she understood of her own stuff. And she, you know, I think sick children just, they get on with it and they just, they're used to it and it's part of their life. But I think for Lynn, looking at her, was probably hard. And she loved her, but of course she still got her nerves, because Lynn was going on to like 12 and whatever. And you know, she kind of, there were times she, please get her out of my room and done this, that and the other, you know. So, but she did, she absolutely adored her. But she did, she was a bubbly little thing. Again, she ate pretty well, as you know, as well as a heart child, and probably better than some. And she built up, and she was, to all intents and purposes, if you looked at her, she'd be fine. People who wouldn't know, except her breathing. Her breathing was never great, and they did check her airways because of all that, but actually her airways were fine. It was just all probably from all the ventilation and stuff. She would be, if you'd hear her coming now, do you know. And we got so used to that, we didn't pay any attention. But like one of my friends, one time we brought her out and she was kind of quite shocked, and we were saying, what? And because we were so used to it. We didn't even notice it.
Do you look back on those years now, those few years where she was building, her strength was building, and you guys, all of you were together? Are those years very precious now when you look back on them?
They are, and we had, thank God we had, even though there was always, you know, she was never 100% by any means, but she was fairly good and we're grateful for that. And you know, we had lovely times and built them up until it came to the end. But the end, as you probably know, was pretty horrific, because it was the end of one journey and the start of another. So it was pretty hard.
I'm going to ask you now what happened then, because this actually is almost the shocking part that it can happen to one person.
I think everybody in Crumlin, even though obviously you can imagine what they see in Crumlin, and often we saw families ourselves with safe children with cystic fibrosis. I remember one with three children, and I remember thinking, my God, three with cystic fibrosis. But I suppose it was the way it happened for us, because Lynn had always been a well child. Finally, after being cancelled again in the July of that summer, 99, Lynn had been away with friends actually for 4 weeks. weeks in Spain, and then they came back and they were going to the Great. So we didn't see much of Lynn at all. She was probably 13 because she'd started first year. She had done first year in second level, and she was due to go into second year. It was the 30th of August, finally, we kind of went in. We went in on the Sunday, and the Monday then was the 30th. And they got her prepared for the surgery. And again, we had to go ahead, and that was it. There was no choice. But anyway, the next day came and Lynn was starting back in second year. So we just let her go on into school. I mean, she was always quite advanced, Lynn, and I think she had to learn to be more, you know, than maybe some other children might be. So we just said, go ahead. She was down in the Navan Road, it was close to us, and she got her bus herself. And we didn't know how it would go, the same thing. We thought, well, you could be cancelled again. So the day went on, and actually we thought we were going to be cancelled. Brendan came in after he finished work. He was a postman, so he finished early. And I'd been there, but I'd stayed all night. Didn't sleep very much, you can imagine. And she hated getting the needle, even though the needle wasn't going into her, Laura, because of all the needles, you know, she'd scream, even though it was actually going into the, you know, not into her arm itself, into the cannula thing. But anyway, it came to about three or something and Brendan was there and I said, well, you better go on. We'd sort of said to Lynn, he might pick you up at school, but if he's not there, just go ahead home as well and we'll let you know, whatever, we'll call you. And there weren't really mobile phones at that time, or we didn't have any anyway. So I remember he was literally left the hospital, and as soon as he left, they said that Laura was going to go down. Now, this was around half three or something like that, or closer to four. And the child before was just tonsils. It was a Down syndrome little girl. So they cancelled. I think they, because we'd been cancelled before, they didn't want to do it again. So I remember asking them, could we ring home? And we had to ring from the nurse's station. And I remember, I'll never forget, I always say it, Laura just said, goodbye, Linny. She called her Linny. She said, I'm going to get fixed. Oh. And I remember thinking, you know, it was funny how she said, and they all kind of laughed like as well. But anyway, that's what she said. Yeah. So that were, they were her last words ever to Lynn, or to, I suppose, to anybody. Now, she was happy going down. It was very strange. You know, she was, the trolley was so whatever. And I think she sensed my nerves though, because, you know, she said, I need to go to the toilet and all, because obviously she was well trained at that stage. We got to the theatre, and again, I won't go into it because it's just, I still, that's one thing I don't talk too much about. I don't know. I'd never seen. I'd seen several of the Denise sisters. Yeah. I'd known some of them. I mean, I'd known them well. But this fella, I had actually never seen him before. Now, I don't know. I still don't know what the story about that was. So I was literally there on my own with him, and I was that side, and Laura was on the bed. And again, because he went to take the arm. Now, he wasn't going to put anything in her arm, but she didn't know that. It was going into the cannula. And he said, she was kind of sitting up. And he did. He put it in, but Laura just fell back. And that's the last I saw of my child alive. Now, I didn't know that at the time, of course. And luckily, my friend Maura, who I just spoke about earlier, who was over admissions, had come up. She knew, I don't know maybe how she knew, but anyway, she was waiting for me outside. So Elisa had her, and we went down, and we went to the cafe, and we, you know, we said we'll have a cup of coffee. And then Lynn and Brendan, Lynn had gone on home, and that's how we had ran. Lynn had got home just before Brendan got her, so they came back in. So that was probably about 5 o'clock, I don't know. And I remember Lynn was starving because she'd had nothing, and she just said, I'll get something to eat. So she got a burger and chips or something. And even though you might laugh, the hospital food mightn't be the greatest, but she loved her food, and she'd eat. And when she, you know, she really did like her food, we all did. And she started to eat. Now, we didn't notice this at the time, but she probably ate about two chips and one bite of the burger. And she was actually starving. So I don't know. We knew subsequently why that was, but I didn't notice it at the time. But anyway, for whatever reason, we came out.
Nerves or anything.
Yeah,
or
anything. I didn't really even think about it, because it was only later we thought about it because of other things. But we went off out anyway. Maura came out with us, and Brendan had said to me, but probably Lynn, as I say, had been away like for almost the 6 weeks, so we really didn't see much of her. And she had a nice tan, she took a nice colour. So he had said to me a couple of days before, when we did see her finally around that time, he said, she looks very pale, do you not think she looks very pale? And I said, well, not really, like she has a colour. And I said, it's probably the late nights and they were in the Gaeltacht and all that sort of thing, and her age, you know. Well, 13. Yeah. So I didn't pay any attention. But funny, he had picked up, because actually his brother, when Brendan was 10, he was 8, he would be my age now, his brother, and he died of leukaemia. But, you know, of course, I wasn't thinking anything. I think Brendan was. When we came out after having the coffee and that, and Brendan said to Maura the same thing, he said, because she had the nursing background, and he said, do you not think she looks very pale? Now, Lynn wasn't complaining. Lynn had said nothing. She did say to me, they'd gone into school on the Friday before that Monday, just for a half day, you know, the way sometimes they go in, and it was a very hot day. And I remember her saying, I don't know if she said she did faint or she thought she was going to faint. That, I did remember that after. But she wasn't complaining. I didn't say anything about not feeling well. So Maura said, yeah, well, I think Maura's words were, she looks shite. And it was kind of strange. And she did say, but look, and Brenda said, well, do you not think we should have her checked out? Now, Lynn didn't object or say anything. And she said, well, you've enough going on up in the theatre. And I don't know. Anyway, we decided that we would. Maura said, well, if you want to then. And Lynn was okay with it, one way or the other. She said, right. So maybe she was feeling something that she never told us. And if that was the case, she never did tell us. But anyway, when Maura said, it's busy in there now. She said, I'll get you in. We'll bring you in later or something. So anyway, basically, to make a long story short, she did go in eventually. And they took the bloods. And I remember Brendan and I were standing either side of the bed. And I did notice there were bruises on her arms. And I probably wouldn't have known anything about that other than, and again, people say, you're making this up, but we're not. My friend's daughter, my best friend's daughter, and this girl was, Lynn loved her. She was very close to her, but there was almost 10 years between them. She called her cousins, we're not blood related, herself and her sister, Lorraine and Gillian. Lorraine was in James's hospital, basically dying from leukaemia. So we knew leukaemia. We only knew Lorraine's leukaemia, which was a different one to the one Lynn had as it happened. But I remember the bruising. I knew there was something about the bruising. But we didn't say anything and nobody else did either. And then I remember some guys came back. I think there were more consultants and they said something about this rash. And I was looking at her body and I was thinking, what rash? Because it was very hard to see. I mean, I could see clearly in those days. But if you looked, it was like a pinprick rash. And sometimes I've subsequently learned that it is. It wasn't all over, but it was in parts. So anyway, we didn't think anymore. I suppose I did. The bruising did kind of concern me, but I didn't think about it because I suppose you just couldn't let yourself. Laura was up in the theatre at this stage. So anyway, we went down to the old hallway. The new entrance opened. So we sat in the old hallway because we knew it would be quiet. And we just said, that's where we are. Like, if and when you need us. Maura had to go home. This is getting late. So obviously she was gone home and whatever. And we sat in the old hall. It was probably around 9 o'clock. And shortly after that, then somebody came from the casualty admissions and just said, we need you to come round. And I remember they brought us round the back and into the sitting room. And again, you kind of say, would it not click with you? And actually, it still didn't. But I never knew this room was there even. And we went in, we sat on this couch, the three of us, Lynn was in the middle. And I remember looking, so there was photographs up there. And then there was all these other people there. I hadn't got a clue who they were, but of course they were the oncology team. And Angus O'Markig was the consultant. He's really lovely as well. So basically just said, I'm really sorry, but Lynn has leukaemia. I'll never forget it. I just looked at this picture and I remember Lynn just sat there and she sort of cried because we knew Lorraine. You see, that was the problem. If we didn't knew nothing about leukaemia, it might have even hit us as much because we might have thought, well, it's another thing that we'll get over this. And of course, at that stage, we didn't know what was happening with Laura. And it was just terrific, you know.
That must have seemed like such a surreal, like you're in some sort of movie where it's not.
Yeah, I think that was it. But she knew it was real. It was real. And, you know, Angus just said, Lynn just looked at him and he said this afterwards. He didn't know we knew anything about leukaemia, of course, at that stage. And she just said to him, will I lose my hair? Will I have my own room? And will I have to have a bone marrow transplant? And he sort of looked at me and thought, how does this girl know anything about bone marrow transplants? He said that. He told us later. He said he was quite shocked with this. But obviously he knew then about Lorraine. In fact, I think he came across Lorraine at one stage because they liaised with the different hospitals before she died. But anyway, he did say the leukaemia she has doesn't need a bone marrow transplant, and it didn't at that point. And he didn't go into any details about that if you relapsed within the first 2 years. But at that stage, he didn't tell us that. We didn't need to know it, and we didn't. So that was it, really.
How did Lynn, at that age, your emotions are so hard to handle,
to deal with
anyway,
with
hormones and just development.
Absolutely.
How did she process? I mean, you said she cried a little bit.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine a child that age who's dealing with obviously such a huge loss and trauma with her sister. How did she deal with this information?
Yeah, she just, well, you know, at that stage, obviously, Laura, she knew as well. We all knew Laura was still up in the theatre and we didn't know what was happening with her. So there was the worry of that. No, she was actually, I said she cried, but I don't think she cried. I think she literally asked him those questions straight away. And then she looked shocked, obviously, and she was shocked as we were too. And then we just got up when we had to go straight to oncology. I mean, she was admitted there and then. And I remember walking that corridor, anyone again who knows Crumlin, you know, oncology is like right at the back. We used to laugh with them later on and say, why did you put it down there? It's like as if they're lepers or something. Mm. And they said, no, it's never meant to be that way, but it's just the way it was. Because even when we had been in the early stages with Laura for nearly 7 months there, and Lynn used to go into admissions to my friend and put stuff in envelopes for them and all, when she, you know, she'd be kind of tired and or Laura was in ICU or whatever. But we never really saw a child with a bald head. It is like you're kind of down the other end, except if you'd see them walking, if they had to go for an x-ray or go somewhere. But anyway, we went down, and luckily, I suppose luckily enough, it wasn't too busy. And again, we didn't know this later. This man and his daughter, she was a beautiful girl. She didn't survive either, but she was beautiful and she had this beautiful voice. I remember her singing when we were there for a while. She sang, it was her birthday or someone's birthday, and she sang. But they moved out of the room when they heard, I suppose, down there again, they kind of said, we try and put them in a room, because we had to stay the night as well. And we had a room, this room to ourselves, which would be very rare, as we found out afterwards. You share a room with somebody, and it's very, it was terrible at the time. Now, obviously, there's a new thing there that parents have actually eventually paid for. But it was horrific at the time. And it was a long time after that. And the reason I know that is because I've been back there a few times for different reasons. But that's another story. But they're fabulous now, what they have, except that you don't have the same camaraderie. That's the thing. So I don't know. Like they put up the little beds for us, and Lynn obviously got into the bed that was there. And I don't know. I suppose we kind of did sleep a little bit. I mean, it's the early hours of the morning. We were called up first, sorry, at 11:30. And one of the team told us that Laura was, you know, it was very seriously ill, and that it had gone as well as they hoped it would go, but he didn't sound great. Again, he was very, very pessimistic. So we kind of had a feeling things weren't great. But you had to hope, because, you know, you had no other thing to do. So I don't know. I suppose about 3 o'clock in the morning, they got us tea and there's a bit of toast or something. And they were in and out. I can't remember too much of that. But we did lie down and try and sleep. And I can't even imagine. I don't know if Lynn even, you know, I suppose she closed her eyes. But at about 3 o'clock in the morning, then we were called up and to the ICU. And they just said that things weren't looking great, that Laura, instead of weaning stuff off, yeah, they were giving her more and more stuff. So they said it didn't look very good. So we kind of knew there wasn't a lot of hope. It didn't sound like it, but you still had to hope she was alive, and you hope maybe she would pick up. But I suppose at 9 o'clock the next morning or something like that, I think they called us in and they just said that she was brain dead, so she wasn't going to live. So there was no point in you know, there was nothing they could do, basically, you know. So it was pretty tough. And then they started to think about bone marrow, and that's when we first heard about the bone marrow, even though we knew with Lorraine. But and they just said, just in case, that's when I suppose we realised that Lynn, if she did ever relapse. And that was a hard decision. I didn't find it so hard, because I thought, well, if Laura isn't, well, she was alive on the machines, but, you know, she's not going to live. And I was thinking, if she could talk, even at four, she'd say, she'd take it. So Angus did say, he was lovely, and I'm sure it must have been very hard for them, because I don't think they'd ever seen this scenario before, really, even though they'd seen horrific things, obviously. But he just said, I'll they have to do the needle thing at the back, and he said, I may not get enough. I'll know whether I can get enough, some sort of syringe thing. He knew if he needed to do it, or if there was any point in doing it. And he said, she won't feel anything or whatever, which of course she wouldn't have. So it was Brendan more so, funny. I just found he was kind of nearly against it for whatever reason. I don't know. I suppose he was thinking, will she suffer more? Now, I did think that too, but Angus assured us that wouldn't happen. So anyway, he did this whatever syringe thing he had to do, and it turned out that he wouldn't have got enough anyway. So that was that decision. So there was nothing to be done there. And we had to tell Lynn, of course, as well. So that was pretty hard. I can't remember clearly when we told her first and her reaction, but she did come up. I said to her, do you want to come up, you know, to see Laura? So she was very iffy, because she was already started her own treatment at this stage, and she was quite weak. And she did come up anyway in the morning time, and she spent a little bit of time. And I don't know, maybe you block it, or maybe you just don't remember exactly, but it was all pretty sad, as you can imagine. And I mean, she looked like she was just asleep, obviously, you know. She didn't look dead or anything. Well, she wasn't, I suppose, at this stage. She was still on the machine. So in the afternoon, then they said it was time, we needed to take her off. So we had a little confirmation ceremony, that's what it was, in the morning. And Lynn came up, and she took Lynn's, we gave her Lynn's name and all of that. And her friend actually was allowed to come with her, Siobhan. She came up, and it was nice that she was there. I suppose we had people in the hospital. And then they said in the afternoon, we needed to take her off. And I said to Lynn, do you want to come up now? Because this was the time. And she said, I've been there, I don't want to. And I just said to her, well, look, we'll go up and we'll wait for a little while. I said, in case you change your mind, because I felt she would. would always regret if she didn't. Mm. Now, I don't know whether she would or she wouldn't, but she still had to make the choice herself. So she did. She came up. She arrived up. We did wait a few minutes, and for whatever reason, I think Siobhan was still with her. So it was nice she had her anyway. So we just took her off and we just held her. You know, she looked asleep. She really didn't. I suppose with children, they don't really look dead the way an adult would, you know. But it was, it was horrific, you know. Yeah.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you're looking for a safe haven to express how you feel, share articles, photos, and memories of your loved ones, join the Grief Encounters Facebook group, a place for support, compassion, and empathy for those grieving.
How did you shift then from, obviously, the next few days you had...
We had her
you
in
had to
there,
plan a funeral,
yeah.
And you had to go through... all of that, and then change your focus completely onto Lynn. How did you do that?
I suppose in one way, you know, you didn't have time to think with the whole, with what was going on. You had to, you just had to literally kind of take a step at a time and do what you had to do. We just decided we'd bury Laura with my mother and father in Glasnevin, and Brendan's mother and father, both our parents were dead at that stage as well. My mother actually died when she was only 50 and I was only 20. So her anniversary was there recently. But she died of lung cancer, strangely, as well. We decided we'd put her with my parents, I suppose, again, trying to think or not think. Yes, whatever. It was pretty horrific. Lynn, as I say, was already inpatient. So she did come home, I think, as far as I can remember that evening. And we just did the funeral. You know, we didn't bring Laura home. We had her in Crumlin. I would have liked to bring her home, but Lynn didn't want her to come home for whatever reason. I don't know why. So we thought, well, it's easier for there. And it was a lovely little room that she was in, and in fairness, but it's not a place really that you'd want your child or that you want to be there. You know, your home would have been nicer if things had been different, I suppose. But anyway, we did go to the church, and I remember we carried the little coffin and that, and then we just, and now if it was now, you just do it all in the one day, I suppose, but then you still did the kind of evening thing and then the next day. So Lynn did, as far as I know, Lynn came home that night and stayed with us, I think she did, and then we just had the funeral, which we barely remember. We had the church anyway, we just literally, I think Lynn went back to Crumlin, I think on the evening of the thing, because I'm almost sure the priest said, well, they have to go, and we did. And then the next day, we got her, and we came and just literally buried Laura with our my parents, and then we literally had to just drive back to Crumlin.
But how did you walk through the doors of Crumlin, having just left without one of your kids? How did you go back in?
I don't know. I suppose
how do you get that strength?
I suppose we hadn't got any choice, really. Yeah. Do you know, we had to go back, and that was it. I remember thinking, my God, this place, like, we're back here again, and where we had to go, like, as I say, the corridor was so long. Angus used to say when his office was over one side, and he said he walked so many, I don't know, a couple of miles a day or something, if he had to go several times, and that's how far it was. And I'll never forget walking back in there, but there was nothing we could do, and you just went back in and you had to start the treatment. And she did, she did well in the sense that the first chemo, I think she was a little bit sick on, she wasn't sick on chemo after that, which was a blessing I suppose, in itself. And then obviously the hair started to fall out. And she'd get in and out a bit, all right. She wasn't constantly in, but initially she was in for quite a bit, and I suppose overall. But then 10 weeks later, Lorraine died. Lorraine died on her 22nd birthday in James's Hospital. And Lynn was really... I hadn't seen her cry or really talk much about Laura, because I suppose she was concentrating on herself. She was also thinking about Lorraine. And I had only brought her to see Lorraine about a month, or maybe 6 weeks before, whenever, probably just before she'd gone away. And Lorraine, it was the July of that year, just early July. And I remember saying to her, now, Lorraine doesn't look very well. Now, everybody still had hope that Lorraine would actually live. I mean, we didn't know that Lorraine would die at that stage. And I remember the day I brought her, this is very strange really, I think I did write it in the book as well. I remember we drove over and went into James's, and I said to her, now she's not looking great and whatever, because obviously she was very, very sick and really wasn't that long before she died. And Lynn sat up with her, and there was people in, her mum and a few, because they have a huge family, there was loads of people, and she sat up chatting to Lorraine. She just adored Lorraine, even though there was that thing between them, because they knew her from the time she was tiny, you know, herself, Lorraine and Gillian, her sister. But anyway, I remember when we were driving home, Lynn said, God, I was just thinking, Mum, imagine if I got leukemia. I'd always remember that. And actually, she possibly had it at that stage, because that was the July. Mm. I just don't know. And I said, no, of course, that'd never happen. Never known what was ahead. But she just, I don't know, she just got on with it, and she just went through the treatment. The hair then, she decided it was falling out, and Gillian, Lorraine's sister, she went to Lorraine's funeral, and that's the first time I saw her cry in that church on the Navan Road. And she was obviously thinking about Laura as well, and that's the first time. But again, we had to go straight back to the hospital.
But at that point as well, she already had the same thing. So in her head, she must have been thinking, am I going to be next?
Yeah, there must have been something. The only thing, I suppose, at that point, it was the different leukemia. It was ALL she had, and AML is what Lorraine had. And Lorraine always needed the bone marrow transplant, which she had, which didn't. And her sister was the perfect match, but it didn't work. Mm. But Lynn probably thought, well, at least I have the hope that, because at that stage, she was going to relapse, but she didn't know that and whatever, you know. So she got her head, she got Gillian, just shaved the head. There was no point, you know, when it starts to come out. And she still looked... like she was, you know, she was lovely, and she never lost her eyelashes or her eyebrows, and she had beautiful eyebrows and her eyes, she had big eyes, and you could see them. I always thought she looked lovely. And I remember there was another consultant, and he was very involved with the Children's Hospital there. I still keep in touch a bit with some of them and that, but and probably because of Laura Lynn. But he wasn't our consultant, but he was funny, and Lynn of course wouldn't suffer fools gladly, and she said, you know, he'd drive her mad sometimes. Any questions? And he wasn't her consultant. Yeah. She loved Angus, she's very, everything was very straight with Lynn, but she said, she'd say, here's any questions, whatever. And then he had this camera, a digital camera or something at the time, they'd probably only come out or something. And he was saying, I used to say, is he a consultant or a photographer? And he'd come in and he took a photograph of it. And actually, I think the photograph's in the book. He took a photograph and he'd sent us the four, and they were beautiful, of her with the head shaved and that. And then one time he came in way after that, I think it was after she relapsed even, and there was something on her finger. It was nothing as it turned out, but maybe he wanted to show it to his, you know, the medical guys or whatever. He said, can I take a photograph of that? And she said, yeah. And he came in the next day and he says, do you want to copy that? She basically told him what to do with it. But anyway, she was so cheerful. She was great. She got the first 8 months sort of was the protocol she was on, and she was in remission after the 8 months. But I can't remember exactly when that was, but she only got 5 months before the next Christmas she relapsed. And I remember thinking, could she not have had one more Christmas even with, you know, thinking she was okay. Yeah, it was terrible. And then it was pretty horrific treatment after that. And Angus did say to her, and again, he always said, did I say the right thing? She sat down in front of him with us behind, and he sat there, and there was a nurse with him. And he just said, Lynn, you've relapsed, and the only thing now is towards the bone marrow. And he said, the treatment's pretty horrific. You can take it or leave it. And I remember asking him afterwards, I said, what if she'd said she'd leave it? He said, I think I knew Lynn well enough, and he said I would have given her all the reasons why she might change her mind. Yeah. So, but it was the best way with Lynn. It was the only way. Now she didn't even look around at us. She just said, I'll take it. But it was pretty horrific. She fitted in the January, and she ended up in Beaumont having to get her head open because they thought it had gone into her head. And I don't know how many hospitals. I said to her, by the time you're finished in, you'll be in every hospital in this country or whatever, between one thing and another. And it wasn't that. It was just the whole system. I mean, I feel, now it's terrible to say this, but and it's not true, because thank God a lot do get through, but I kind of feel that if the leukemia doesn't kill you, the treatment will. Mm. Now, she still got through it. She, you know, she got through so much and finally got to. There were no matches in the family, but they had matches on the, you know, this system, worldwide thing, yeah, and the system. And we went to Luke's that day. You had to, at that time, would you believe, you had to go to Glasgow to get this thing that they have to do before the bone marrow thing.
So she'd fly?
Well, we didn't. No. We didn't in our case. But they had little children. Imagine families having to go.
Trauma.
And I think that's what Angus, I think he begged, because she was borderline, she was 14, whatever, she was 15 at this stage, or going on 15 around that time. And I think he just said to Luke's, will you please do this? Mm. You know, she's kind of an adult anyway. And I think, and that was back then. I don't know what they do now, but thank God we didn't have to do that, because even to try and get the, you know, to go. So we went to Luke's that day, and I remember because my mother had been in Luke's, and that was the first time ever I was over there, and then I couldn't go in, which I had to go in to get this treatment thing they do. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but anyway, that was fine. We came out and we were waiting for the taxi back to Crumlin, and that morning, like, we'd gone from Crumlin and gone back over, and there was a swing there, and she had these she'd gotten them for her birthday, which had been on the 11th of March, so it was just a few weeks before, the runners. She loved runners. They were in that shoe in the end of a concert. We'd race around to try and get, because she was a size 6, and I remember getting them, and she had them on her, and there was a pool of muck under the thing, because I'd be very fussy anyway, and she was swinging on the swing, and I remember thinking, don't put your shoes in. Yeah. She said, for God's sake, Mum. Anyway, we got back to Crumlin that day, and that was the day, and one of the nurses, she was from Donegal, and Lynn really liked her, and she only worked part time, and she normally wouldn't be there, but she was there that day, and she said, I just want to take some bloods when we got back. And I said, but she took bloods this morning. Mm. I just knew there was something. And she said, oh no, but there was something about the menu. She says, I have to take them again. And then in the meantime, this other guy came from the head place, whatever it's called.
Neurology.
Neurology. And he had been with her already. And he came just out of the blue now. Mm. And he said to her, I want you to draw a man. Anyway, she drew the man. Well, she wasn't great at drawing, but she was okay, better than I'd be. And she'd also done a test that they do before a bone marrow transplant. She'd done half this test. She had to go down with someone, and she had done it, and she was going to do the other half of it that afternoon. And then he came, and he kind of disturbed that, and she drew the man. This was all obviously to do with maybe the brain thing or whatever. I don't really know. And in the meantime, Eileen had taken the blood. And actually, Eileen was very funny, because she was from Donegal, and she had come a couple of times. She threatened Daniel O'Donnell on Lynn. And of course, you can imagine, I don't want Daniel O'Donnell, Robbie Williams or something she wanted. So she used to have great banter with Eileen. They said she was supposed to stay in that night, and she was having something else the next morning. This was all part of the going towards the transplant. And she always said, I remember she wrote in one little diary, I don't care if it's 3 o'clock in the morning, if I can just get home to my own bed. So she said to them, now I'd say they knew at this stage, they knew, they must have known something. They said, I remember, I think Angus was there, and they said, look, you can go home tonight and you come back in the morning, Lynn. And of course, she was delighted getting home to her own bed. So we went home, and I just knew there was something. So I rang, and I couldn't get Angus that afternoon. And we actually went up to Brendan's sister and had food. And she wasn't eating that well. When she could eat, even still all through the illness, she would eat really well if she could. Mm. And she'd try to eat when she couldn't. But she didn't, and she looked a bit weak, all right. And then I couldn't get Angus earlier. And then when we got home, it was around 10, and I rang again. And he used to go home to his children. He had young children. He'd come back in. Anyway, he rang me back around 11 or something like that, and that's what he said, I'm sorry, it's back, there's nothing we can do, there's no point in the transplant. I remember thinking, I said, how am I going to tell her? And he said, I'll tell her if you like. And it's not that we wouldn't tell her. Brendan was upstairs, he'd gone up, he often sat with her, you know, just at the bed, I suppose, because of the way she was. And he came down, I told him, and I just said, I remember we went to bed that night, and we just thought, well, you know, we can't, there's nothing anybody can do. And I did say to Angus, I said, well, we'll come in the morning. I said, we'll see if we don't tell her. I said, maybe it's best you do tell her, because she really did have a great, good, that's kind of relationship with him. And again, I said to him, I don't want to go to the ward. Now, when we got there, we said we'd meet him at the end of this ramp, and we knew where it was. And I didn't know he had an office up at the top of the ramp, because he headed up as if he's gone to the ward. And she knew, I'd say. She knew anyway. We did. Now, there's no reason why we didn't tell her, because it was all very open. But for whatever reason, we didn't. And I'd say she knew. She knew there was something up, because you don't meet Angus at the ramp. And then we went to the office. It was the same office that she had told her about the relapse, I think. Or no, it probably wasn't, because actually I'd never been in this office before. But anyway, we sat there and it was just him and a nurse. And it was the same thing. She just sat there in front of him and he just said, and he questioned himself afterwards, because he did ask me about that. He's just said to her, Lynn, I'm sorry, you know, the leukemia is back and you're going to die. And I remember she just sat there and she just cried a little. That's when she cried. And she said, how long have I got and what way will I die? And he couldn't really, I mean, we'd seen a few children already, so you can imagine he couldn't really tell her. He just said, look, you could get anything up to 8 weeks, which I think we all knew wasn't going to happen. Mm. And he said, your body will kind of wind down. And that was it. She said, I thought to myself, if you lie down there and die now, I don't blame you. But I knew she wouldn't. I kind of knew she wouldn't, and she didn't. She literally got up and she was determined to live every minute that she had. And she got nearly 3 weeks, which was wonderful. It really was.
What
did you do in the 3 weeks?
Those 3 weeks
they really were. And they're the things that, you know, the way you say when you look back and maybe what gives you the strength. No, they definitely were. How she lived those weeks. And I mean, she really did. I remember the priest at her funeral said, Lynn thought, he was a friend of ours as well. He was kind of a real alternative priest, and he spoke out and stuff like that. So she loved him. She wouldn't have been religious now. I didn't particularly go regularly to Mass or her, but she used to come when she was younger. Mm. And she asked for Ciarán in that last week, because she really liked him. And he said how she taught us how to live and she taught us how to die. There were wonderful weeks and people were wonderful, and physically she was able to do so much. It was great, because she literally was. I mean, we were worn out. Yeah. She physically, she got the strength and she had it. And it was amazing, because she was actually dying, and she knew she was dying, obviously. We went to Manchester, Westlife were brilliant. Oh. People paid for us to go. Yeah. And it was just friends through Moira in the hospital. They paid for us to this beautiful place to stay, and there was a limousine. They paid for a flight. They were wonderful now. It was Niall Quinn and his wife and her sister and her, and we didn't even know them now, but they knew the story, so they did that. And then she got her make-a-wish was on the kind of way anyway, and her make-a-wish was the famous Robbie Williams, which we didn't know was ever going to happen, because he was going away. Now, that was just before we knew she was going to die, and then we knew, so we had to, the wish had to come quicker, obviously. So she picked the third wish, Dromoland, and again I think she kind of nearly picked that for us. Now, Dromoland Castle wasn't a place we would have gone to, not in those days, because we just couldn't have afforded it. But I mean, it was something else now. But I really think she did it for us. But she had great fun. We were allowed to bring her friend and my friend, and a whole load of us came. And the same in Manchester, with some that came with us. And Dromoland was great, like, because it was just so kind of not our thing. I remember the room. She walked into the big suite and she said, oh my God, this is bigger than my whole house. Well, we have a video that Gillian came with us and she took video. So it was lovely. And then Manchester was fabulous. I have to say, those boys, because it was more than just the meet and greet, because these people knew them. We were actually in the dressing room with them for about an hour, and they brought out Brian McFadden at the time, and it turned out that Siobhan, her friend, her mother is a teacher in Rosmini, and she had taught Brian McFadden. Uh-huh. But anyway, they all went off the stage, and he was with Kerry Katona at the time. She was a few months pregnant, and we were in this beautiful suite, and Nicky Byrne, he was really nice to us, the oldies, as we called ourselves, myself and Brendan and Dolores, my friend who had lost Lorraine. And we were there, and he got us a glass of wine and got a beer for Brendan, and then the boys came back with the girls, but they'd lit it, because it's a huge, I don't know if you've ever been in it, the Manchester Arena. Oh my God, it's enormous. And of course they had great fun, and Brian McFadden, apparently he wasn't supposed to be looking out through the curtain, he was doing all sorts of things because he was a bit crazy, of course. And then they all came back and they all sat with us and talked, and eventually Nicky Byrne looked at his watch, he said, we better get ready for the show. And then Lynn said to him, you better sing something for me now. And the third song in Swear It Again, he sang for her, you know. It was very sad. I was just wishing it was a different reason he was singing it for her. But they sat outside on the thing, we kind of sat in the thing, but it was wonderful. I mean, you know, all the things we did various other things as well, and it was just amazing. Like, and then the week that her body did, obviously she couldn't take any more and she was getting closer, and that last kind of few days, I suppose the best part of a week, maybe, she kind of wound down and she was in the bed.
She stayed at home.
And we that was her one wish, and that's what led me to Laura Lynn. But she wrote her letters of thanks and she did all sorts of things like that. She only had one little fit and that was it. She could have fitted a lot and could have bled a bit, but thankfully none of that happened and we were able to manage the fit. And she still was able to eat and stuff. And I don't know, she just had this strength or something. And Kieran, the priest, you know, Kieran Dunn came down to her a couple of times and we asked him afterwards, you know, without breaking any kind of confidence, is what did she say? And he said her one worry was about us, how we'd survive without her and Laura. But I don't know whether it's because Laura and Lorraine, of course, was gone, and whether, because she, as I say, she wouldn't have been particularly religious, but I think she had this feeling that she was going to go to them, and that she, you know, that she'd be okay and whatever. But she just did, yeah. And then when she wasn't able to write, I wrote the letters for her, but she dictated, you know. She was just, I don't know, she really had courage beyond her 15 years, you know, and I don't know if I'll ever have that courage.
I think you have. I think it's amazing. After that point, then obviously Laura Lynn, the children's hospice happened.
Yeah, that's what led. Lynn did say, it was the one thing she said. She said, I don't want to go back to Crumlin, because she knew there was a possibility if she fitted a lot or something. And she said, she loved, you know, she really appreciated what Crumlin did, as we did for both the children, even though they couldn't save them. But she didn't want to go back, and she wanted, her other wish then was to be buried with Laura, for Laura to be brought to be buried with her. She picked where she wanted to be buried. It's a little church there in Castleknock Village, churchyard. It's actually Church of Ireland, but it's that she really knew, and Lorraine was buried there. I think that was partly why. And literally, you can't choose your grave there unless you're dead. But anyway, we laughed at that. But actually, they put her, well, they didn't do it purposely, but it just by chance. Lorraine is here, and there's an old person who actually gave me some money for the charity from time to time. She lived not too far from us, and her husband are there, and she's there. So she couldn't have got closer if she tried in that sense. And then her wish was that we brought Laura. So that was hard 6 months later, because we had to, to go. Now, we only went on our own to Glasnevin, and they didn't want us to go even, but we did go, and they took her up because they weren't sure, I suppose, what way the coffin would be, but it was still completely intact. And then we brought it, and it was just Brendan and I. It was very hard, and they had to open Lynn's grave again, but it was the one thing she wanted. And I suppose for us it was the funeral that we didn't remember, so in a way it was kind of like resting the two of them, you know, together. But I thought, what led me then was really that, because she wanted to die at home. And I thought, I remember not long after, I don't know when the thought came in, I just said, if she hadn't, we irrationally would have felt guilty probably forever, even though, we would have known there was nothing we could do. So I'm so glad that we got that, but that's what led me to it. And then when I realised there was none here and I started to do the research, I realised how much it really means to people. It's not really about the death at all. That's part of it. If home isn't possible and you don't, you know, hospital, hopefully you can avoid it. But it was the way, the respite for the families. And of course, a lot of the children or 24-hour care, it would be slightly different to Lynn or Laura, you know. Either of them might have had some use, maybe probably more at the end, but it's more for, you know, 24-hour care, really complex conditions, and the difference it makes.
I think a hospice provides, I mean, it's actually, they're probably the most special places on earth. There's some sort of tranquility and peace that it's unlike anywhere else. But what you talked about is it gives you that time, that kind of quiet, and that space to connect and spend time together. That's not a hospital. It doesn't have all those fears and noises and people coming in and out. And
even the stuff is kind of hidden, you know, the medical, you have to have it, but it's kind of hidden. And it really is that home from home. And just for the other children like that, as you had said earlier, you know, the siblings and all, because life just isn't the same. And particularly, I mean, I look at these families that I know, and I'm very grateful for what we did have, you know, the time we had, and that we didn't have this constant 24-hour care. We had a touch of it, obviously, more with Laura, I suppose, but, you know, we didn't, and then I'm grateful for the years that we had, whereas these children are born with this, and, you know, it is from day one, like, it's literally 24-hour care, and it's very, very tough.
And as you said earlier as well, it is very hard on the siblings that are already there, because they're living, it changes their life as well, does. And they're living their lives. How has, because you talked to various people about setting up charities or doing something, whether it's a website or whether it's some sort of action to better something as a result of their grief. How has that helped you? set up the hospice. How has that helped you not come to terms, but just live every day?
Yeah, I think it was a big help because now that I've pulled back a lot, now all these years down the road, I find part of me misses it. Like part of me is glad because I'm getting older and you can't keep up that kind of pace. I often wonder if I didn't do it, how would I still have survived as well as I hope I would, and I hope I would have done something. But I do think it played a big part. Yeah, I think so. I hope so because I suppose. It kept us doing stuff, and we were doing stuff that we knew would mean something to somebody. Now, you know, so I'm glad it was that I did. Mm. But yeah, I often think, what would I have done, and would I have survived as well? Yeah. Because I do find now, even pulling back, and I don't know whether it's maybe all these years later. Sometimes these things hit you, you know, way down the road that you do. You know, the enormity of it in the beginning, and you're kind of
the
newly
first
numb.
Is quite a blur.
Yeah,
it's quite a blurry,
exactly.
Sort of.
Yes, you know, so you don't know.
Weird and limbo.
But I do find, I miss the girls more and more each year now. You know, Laura's birthday would have been the 20th there last Sunday week. And, you know, she would have been 20. She'd be 24 if she was here now. And Lynn will be 33 now in March. Wow. So, you know, and Lynn will be gone 18 years this year and Laura will be gone 20. So, you know, it's kind of, it's a long time. But I do miss them more. I think about them more. And I find them a little bit more down. And maybe that is partly because I was so busy. I didn't have time to think and whatever. I don't know. And yet we were dealing with it in a way because it was always like all the, you know, interviews and different things. It was always having to tell the story and talk. Yeah. But I'm so glad now. And people like that, that's what I have to say. Like people are good. I still to this day, like, because a couple now that she writes books, Fran and Arthur, her husband, herself and her husband, and they publish the books and all. They're great. And they give literally every penny to Laura Lynn. And they do all the shows. Now they started off years ago. She rang me one day. It was really funny. I got this phone call when I'd started off, and obviously she heard me on an interview or something, and she got my number and she rang and she said, now I've written a few books and whatever, and she said, but I never did anything with them. And anyway, she went on and on. I can go on and on myself, as we know. Brendan said, yeah, no one can go on more than you. But anyway, we were on the phone for about an hour, and I went, Fran knows this now, and she said, you know, I said to myself, I'll never hear from her again, because she said, I want to do something. I think I'll get them published or do something anyway. And I was very wrong about that one, because 12 books later and they've raised over $500,000 now.
That's amazing.
And they, but when I go and help them at the stands, because they literally do all the shows now, like Bloom, the RDS, they do all the shows there, and they go around the country. They've spread like the word as well, as apart from the money, they've really, they're great ambassadors, and they love doing it and all that. But when you're there, I was only there with them at the holiday show. I just go for an hour and a half. Now these people, they're in their 70s, you would never think it, but they stand there for at all these shows for 5 days, maybe Christmas shows, and they're long. I don't know how they do it, because a couple of hours is enough for me. But anyway, you're there and you see the people are just so, and this is all these years later, where, you know, and they give and give and give. Only for all of the people, we would never have had it. Do you know, it would never be there.
And how did you find yourself and Brendan getting, like, it's very hard for two people to grieve in the same way. Yeah. And it's very hard for relationships to endure. Even they can be sibling relationships, parent relationships, but couples, it can be very, very difficult to endure something so huge and to get through it. How did you guys...
I don't know. I often wonder, really. So somehow, some people do say that. Are you still together? It's a question I would have often gotten asked, because when I did the research, even in around, you know, lots of places, England and Scotland and Wales, a lot of families, the marriages didn't survive. Yeah. And that was even with other children. I don't know. I suppose Brendan was always there with me, but he was in the background a lot, and then and he was working and stuff. And I don't know. We just got on, and we do. And he wouldn't have talked as much or talked as openly as I would. And I do think that everybody grieves differently anyway, but I think men and women particularly, you know, grieve somehow. I suppose we just, you know, I think Lynn, again, just the way she dealt with what she did, and she probably helped him a lot. He wouldn't talk about it that much really now, you know, but I can see he's pretty brokenhearted, and I often looked at him and thought, you know, I felt sorry for myself, but I felt even sorrier for him, because I think men, they do find it, particularly men of his generation, our generation, you know, maybe younger people now, hopefully, I think boys and men, they're more open, anyway, I hope they will be. But I think, you know, it was hard. And I think because he felt he couldn't, maybe, or didn't want to, or whatever.
Do you do something in their memory every year for their birthdays, or do you just have a peaceful time, or how do you get through that day?
We don't actually, funny enough. We did the first, the usual, the first we did a mass for each and that. But I haven't, I don't know. Yeah, I find that coming up to the day itself is, you know, the birthdays or the anniversaries are not that hard. Christmas now, while I still like Christmas and parts of Christmas, and but it, that can be hard.
Does it
as well.
Still hit you out of the blue, like you might be in a shop and see something they like and that's
or a song or something, or something that just something that, and it might be the very day that you don't think you're kind of so bad and suddenly then something like that. I found that over the years all right. And then I suppose looking at other children, when I am around some of the families that I'd known, Laura Lynn and that, you know, you're kind of looking and thinking, God, and they have to face it as well, you know. But I know from them as well, and that probably gives us a good lift that, you know, they do say the ones we would know. I don't know everyone because I was never based on the ground anyway, you know, all my work is voluntary and that, but I would be in and out, and I'm still in touch even though I've pulled back a lot. I'm actually meeting the CEO tomorrow now, she's a new CEO or relatively, you know, and they're kind of looking at, you know, doing maybe something different, a new strategy that they're looking at, so I want to find out. But it is the families that I do know, and the ones that sadly their little ones are gone now, and they're lovely, and they just say, they really say all the time how much it meant, and they couldn't have survived without it. They would have had to if it wasn't there, I suppose, but the fact that it's there. So that's why I think I feel so strongly about it, you know, and that it keeps going and that it is helping them. It can't change the end, unfortunately, you know, but at least
what a beautiful legacy.
And it's a legacy
you have left behind for your two girls. I mean, their names.
Yeah, someone said that. Yeah, when we're gone, their names will still be there.
Their names are so familiar to people. And you guys took something that's truly unimaginable and created a beautiful legacy in both their names. Thanks. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. And
thank you very much too. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.